All right, it is Sunday, March 28th, and I'm Michael Jones, and I'm interviewing Renelda Meeks Higgins Walker for the Metro Housing Coalition's Unfair Housing program that is going to be stored in the University of Louisville Oral History Archive. And Renelda, you were telling me about your, we were talking about Okolona because you have family there, and you were going to tell me it was originally an African-American
community. And there were lots of Black families around there. Of course, I was born in 1950, so I just know about history from the 40s up.
Yeah.
But there were several Black small farms out there. And you know, Black people always had to live together with other Black people because of the housing and because of the community, the overall society. Hmm. We lived together for safety reasons, for one thing. And so Okolona had these farms that were like 10, 20 acres. And we used to go out there every weekend to visit our mother's sister. And I asked you about that because when the barn fell down, we found we found arrowheads. That's what my parents really loved. My mother loved arrowheads and old money. We found musket, the little round things, the ammunition. Mm-hmm. We found so much old stuff that was from 100 years ago. And we were surprised that someone from U of L, I think, had done a history that was a thriving farming community at one point. All I saw, it was in a photocopied booklet form. Mm-hmm. Somebody self-published it, I believe. Mm-hmm. But I think it was a history project done maybe 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting, but we loved going out there. So anyway, let's get started with yours and I'll probably get back to that.
So where was your mother from?
So my mother was born and raised in Tennessee, southeastern Tennessee. My mother's mother was the next to the youngest daughter of a stonemason and sons who were very prolific and very well-to-do from Pulaski, Tennessee. As you know, Pulaski, Tennessee became the home of the KKK. And that's, so anyway, this Black family owned a big, beautiful stone house that was built by Jones Smith and Sons. In Pulaski as well. They had built a beautiful, this stone mansion. It's at the top of the hill that leads down into the business district. Mm-hmm. And they also had a farm out near Abernathy Hill, which is, I think it was 10 acres. And it was, that's about 10 acres and it was about 18 miles outside. We actually had a family reunion there. I could see the house that he built. Mm-hmm. And the house it's on Madison Street in Pulaski, Tennessee. And if you go down the hill, the first business house has a plaque on it that commemorates the founding of the KKK. Mm-hmm. So that they were landowners. The family was a homeowner. They all lived together and they were well known. Mm-hmm. My mother's father was a mountain man. He came from East Tennessee, south of Knoxville. He's a mountain man, but our great grandfather owned a lot of land and he left a lot of property to his boys and daughters. Now we owned some of that, but we lost a lot of it in the late 60s.
So what was your mother's name?
Eloise Klein Meeks. Okay. But I wanted just to tell you that the biggest and most beautiful farm in that area was a Klein farm. It was 100, over 100 acres, 110 acres, I think. And it was gorgeous. We still have property around that area from cousins, you know, we sort of got it from there. She was my great grandmother from Pulaski was a Smith. Our great grandfather from Tennessee was a Kline, K-L-I-N-E. He was a German trapper. Mm.
Yeah. So how'd your mother end up in Louisville?
When Black people traveled, they traveled to family. Mm-hmm. And there was family in Louisville, family in Columbus, family in Chicago. There was also family in Atlanta. They went north. So they went, it gets a little tangled. The Pulaski family, because remember my grandparents married they got married, and one is from Pulaski, one is from East Tennessee. The oldest daughter came to Louisville to live with some of the relatives from Pulaski who had come to Louisville. And Louisville was a big town at that time. It's a river port. It was where you could go. It was exciting, I suppose. And they came to stay with my aunt. They couldn't all stay with my aunt. So they came, I think, after they graduated from school, one at a time. And they met in Louisville. Both my parents met in Louisville.
Yeah. And your father, what was your father's name?
Florian Meeks, Jr. He was Florian Meeks, Jr.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and he was one of the first Black Marines. Is that
he was in the first class of the Marine Corps, 1943. And he hated the Marines. He hated them, and he never talked about it.
Mm. So that's the Montford Point Marines.
Yes, Montford Point Marines. Yeah, he was also he also was a commissioned person. So he went. That was World War II with the Montford Point, but he became a second lieutenant in the army for the Korean War.
Mm-hmm. And so where are you at, and how many kids did they have?
I'm the oldest. There was one boy born before, but he was stillborn.
Oh, okay. So you're the oldest out of how many children?
And I have four brothers.
Okay. And where did you live in Louisville?
So we started out living with what I remember as a baby, living with my aunt, the one that was the first, my mother's oldest sister who came to Louisville. And I just remember when my dad left to go to the war, to the Korean War, we had some pictures. And I remember being with my aunts and my cousins, you know, and we lived in College Court, I think, for a hot minute.
Mm-hmm. Where did your aunt live? Because you had talked to me earlier about Little Africa and
College Court was a housing project that I think it was a development that's still around today. Still around today. They bought out that one of the small properties after we left, at some point when I was very little, but I remember living with them. And here's another anecdote. In New York City, 55 years later, maybe 60 years later, I was coming out of, I used to work at Harlem Hospital. I'm coming out of the subway and somebody comes up to me that I seemed like I had seen her before. And she said to me, "Oh, I know you. I never saw this person." And I said, "No, I don't think so. You don't really talk to people you don't know," but she looked vaguely familiar. She says, "You're from Louisville." And she said Louisville the correct way. So she had my attention. So I stopped and she said, And your mother's name is Eloise. This is a, and you lived in College Court. So now I know she knew exactly who we were. She remembered me as a baby. And she remembered the story. She was up there just for an artist was opening, doing some stuff in the subway system there that was sanctioned by the city. And she was just there. So that was that. These little things happen in there. Incredible. Mm-hmm. Incredible. I'll remember that as long as I live. Her name, I know. But I called my aunt, my cousins right away. And of course, they were my cousin's age. And that's why she remembered me, because my cousins were about 10 years, 8 and 10 years older than me. They were girls and they were like my sisters because I had all brothers. Yeah.
And so you ended up living on Virginia Avenue?
Yes, we did. We ended up, we lived for, I think Mama said about 6 months at 3379 Duval Drive. Mm-hmm. That was the first address that I ever remembered. And my mother drilled it in all of us because it was the projects. What are the projects that are down there? They've been repurposed and they put root.
Yeah, like Cotter Homes.
Cotter Homes, that's where it was. That's where we lived for about 6 months there. Okay. But we moved from there to Virginia Avenue. And they're still there. My family's still there now. One of my brothers is there now. Yep.
So what was the community like growing up on Virginia Avenue?
Well, let me just say, because we were there, so it was a wonderful community. It was a great house. And I remember we had just moved there, or we had been there maybe... No, probably we were getting ready to move there when my mother took us down to Little Africa. So I think we moved to Virginia Avenue in 1954. But I sent you two pictures. I don't know if you received them.
I did.
Yes. Okay. So one of those pictures is a plastic bag that has Little Africa garlic seeds, Little Africa, 1953. So it was somewhere between Cotter Homes and Virginia Avenue that my mother took a very emotional trip, actually. And I must have been, I would be 3 years old, two going on three, because I became three in July. But I remember her taking me and going to say, and she was saying, this is Little Africa and look at all these cute little houses. Everybody was forced to move and there were beautiful, what she did was she went to the gardens. Everybody had a garden, a flower garden or vegetable garden. And they were, it looked like to me as a kid, that it was just a ghost town. People just left for the day. Maybe they would come back, maybe not. But she was saying that they were not gonna, she was telling me that they were not gonna come back. Mm-hmm. And so that was a travesty.
Well, were they not allowed to come back because the projects were being built?
This is part of urban renewal, as far as I know.
Okay.
Yes, that's because what happened was that area was, I guess it was considered a blight. But the issue was these were people's homes. They owned those homes. They were forced to move and they became renters after that because they weren't building houses for people to buy. And if they were, the people, you know, couldn't afford them. They were building to move that community and disperse it. Now, also remember that was right about the Brown. No, that was before Brown versus the Board of Ed. But that was, you know, that was very interesting anyway. Mm-hmm.
A lot of education and. It depends on where you live, especially in the, or now. So what schools did you attend early on?
Okay, so I also sent you some books of, I had sort of put something out because I really wanted to make sure that there were parts that I did not forget. you'll let me do You'll remind me, right, that I can go back, or maybe we'll do this again, because I have a 12:30 conference call that I have every Sunday, which I think I told you. So we lived in a, the house was on near Catalpa, it's right, kind of diagonal from Catalpa and Virginia Avenue. And you could see Parkland Elementary School, which was where all the white kids went. The Black kids went down to Virginia Avenue. So that little, in that picture I showed you, I had, I keep, there's a little button, the ones with the buttons, I collect buttons. Mm-hmm. And this one says 100 great books, mm-hmm. club, Virginia Avenue School. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. So that school, the principal of the school lived right across the street from us. The principal, the pediatrician, Grace James, one of the first female Black pediatricians, lived in the corner house. We had two teachers from Virginia Avenue that lived on our way to walk to school. So we were pretty lucky. I was very lucky because my parents sent us to the Black schools. Mm-hmm. And the Black school, she was very involved in PTA. She started a Girl Scout, a Brownie program, Girl Scout program. She was involved in the, you know, as a den mother. She was involved in the Boy Scouts. I mean, she was involved. There was some stuff. With the Girl Scout. Okay, another thing. Yeah, the questions that you had were really good questions. So I sort of answered the questions in the questions that, and the way they were asked. So we would walk down the street and you're going to school. And I knew if my brothers were in trouble before I got home because the word was spread. So my mother was always involved. Now I'm gonna divert to another little part. Around that same time, so it would have been about 56, and one of these buttons, there was a button that I had nothing new for Easter. Mm-hmm. Here's one that you would appreciate. It says fight to end slums. This was open housing button. So this was one of the buttons. We're on the move. What am I saying that for? So we walked down the school, we walked down to Virginia Avenue, knowing that we were getting a good education. Whereas the kids who went to the other school, the Black kids after 1956, I don't want to be quoted as saying this, but they didn't fare as well. Mm-hmm. I think, but the thing is, when you're totally vested in an area, when you really live in an area, not as a renter or as a transient, but you're vested in that area, then you got time, your family has time to think about educating the children, taking them out to other places. But when you're struggling for rent and for food, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. So you're less likely to do it, or it's more difficult to do it. So housing and food is the precipice of life. Mm-hmm. And it shouldn't be questioned. It should be just is. Everybody has a right to housing because mm-hmm. they need it. Everybody has a right to air. Everybody has a right to water.
Yeah.
What happened, you know? So yes, that's, I think that taking away housing from people, that moving that little Africa. There's another street, Walnut Street. Mm-hmm. It used to be Walnut. What's it called now? Is it Muhammad Ali? Ali.
Yeah.
So we had my dad's only uncle, William Meeks, lived on Walnut Street. And that was the Black business district. Mm-hmm. Most of the businesses were torn down for urban renewal. Few houses were left, and these were shotgun houses. Some of them were shotgun houses. which were really nice. My favorite house in the world, by the way. And I grew up in a gorgeous Victorian. And then the Platos, which was a very famous architect.
Samuel Plato.
Yes, Samuel Plato. He was my dad's idol and mentor, I think. And he had built a house on that street. That's probably why those two areas on Walnut Street were not torn down. But as you can see, if you know, there's a lot of other businesses. They sort of tried to expand the downtown Louisville area. That's what it looks like to me now. Mm-hmm. So we had those housing. Everybody had housing in our family. Everybody was expected to go to school. We never questioned it. Our Virginia Avenue was an excellent, excellent school. A lot of the people I know a lot of people who came from from Virginia Avenue.
So how'd you get involved in the open housing movement?
Well, so let's start with when I was a Brownie, my mother found there was a button that I couldn't find. It was called Nothing New for Easter, very similar to the In the Slums button. So the Nothing New for Easter program, from what I remember, because I was little, was that JCPenney, and I don't want to shout out JCPenney because all the department stores were doing the same thing. You could come and buy clothes, but you couldn't try them on. So most of us sewed. We learned how to sew early. And that was one of the things my mother wanted to make sure I could do, sew. So this one year, Nothing New for Easter campaign was that if you couldn't try it on, you're not going to buy it. So my mother found out that JCPenney was going to have a fashion show with kids. And they were using the Girl Scouts as the models for these children's clothing. So she answered the call our Brownies. And when we showed up, they didn't know what to do with us. They didn't know that there was a Black Brownie troupe. And we showed up. So they let us try on clothes. I know, I just remember two of us. And then they told us, you can have the clothes that you are wearing, but you can't, we're not going to have, it's too long, too many kids. You can't walk the runway. That's what it was. That was my first real experience where I knew that something was happening. And this was JCPenney, but all those department stores in Louisville. So Brownies, I think, are 9 years old. So I must have been 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. That's what I remember.
And so did you start becoming more socially aware? And
you know what? I think any Black family growing up in our area, and with us, we knew what the deal was, but it didn't bother us. We were very protected. We were stable. We were housed. We had a very close, I was saying something. We had if you have a safe community, you'll have a safe family and vice versa. So in our church, which was 1114 South 15th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, still there. It's the minister was my aunt, my grandmother's sister, mm-hmm. my grandmother's sister's husband, mm-hmm. who was another, was an anchor. The church is Church of God, oh. Our Sanctified Church. It's Church of God, our Sanctified Church. And that's the minister, the founding minister was J.S. Woodson. Mm-hmm. And he was the husband of my grandmother's sister. And she had come to Louisville. So, there are lots of ways that we got to Louisville, and that was one of the ways. And we were in the church. All of our relatives were in the church. All the people from Cleveland, Tennessee, who came up were in the church. And a lot of people from Pulaski also belonged to that church. So it was a bond. We were we had something to do every day that had to do with that church. You have, we didn't know it. We didn't experience, for example, we didn't go to the movies because there was no Black movie house, and you could only go to the movies once or twice a week, and you had to stay, you know, sit in one area. We didn't have a bowling alley until my uncle, my dad's uncle, became the manager of one of the bowling alleys, and he was very fair. So a lot of people did not know he was Black. And once they found out, that became the Black bowling alley. You know, we didn't need those kinds of outlets. We would go to my aunt's house in Okolona every weekend without fail. Because remember, my mother's people, half of them were mountain people, and they loved the mountains. They loved the ground. My mother would take us on. We'd go out there and she'd say, take your shoes off. We're going to follow the creek. And that's what we did. We followed the creek. So, I mean, we were always busy. So I was going somewhere, but now I don't even remember where I was going with that.
I wanted to ask you about, because near your home is kind of like where the epicenter was in the 1968.
Let me just tell you.
Okay.
So I heard that we were going to have a speaker from someplace was going to come over to 28th and Greenwood, which is three blocks away, right? Because mm-hmm. we lived at 28th in Virginia. So we walked up 28th Street. Another story don't forget to let me tell you about the library, because that library was a main, it was very important. So I went up there and I was a teenager. So I must've been about 16 or 17. And I wasn't 17, it must've been 16. So there were a few people there. And then when the time came, some guy had a little, I think he got on the hood of a car and started talking. And he wasn't preaching or anything. He was just, I thought it was kind of odd, but he was preaching. He was talking, and he was talking about civil rights and, you know, Black people have to stick together and blah, blah. And then I remember a bigger group was together, people I didn't really know, because we knew everybody in that area. And then what I remember was that there was a bus that came by, and then things started happening in slow motion. When the bus passed the guy who was standing on the car, giving his little speech, a bottle was thrown over the bus in slow motion. And it was a glass bottle, didn't hit anybody. It hit the sidewalk. And then suddenly another bottle came from nowhere. So it was, to me, it was a setup. I don't know who it was, but I tell you, after it looked like people were intent on not being nice, I just walked back home. I was amazed at the amount of damage that was done. I was amazed, because that's not our community. That was not our community. And to this day, it has never returned. To this day, 68 to 2021. And that's a real failure of the town leadership, a real failure. It was very ugly for a long time. And there was a time when you want your parents to be able to, you know, in old age, they had been there. They'd been living in that same house since 1954. And there was a time when they couldn't be there safely. There was also, they started when, for example, the corner where the Grace James, the pediatrician, lived, they sold that house. Somebody, the estate sold it. And rather than build another, you know, fix up that house, they tore down the house and put two little shotgun houses there, and they're rentals. So, I mean, I don't believe that was legal to do that, but it's there to this day. And those, there was, and again, I don't want to be pointing fingers, and I don't want, you know, if this is going to be videoed or anything, just, I don't want to point fingers at the people who lived there, because not all of them were there, but there were drugs over there. There were, you know, weapons over there from time to time. So if you, and if the city let that happen right across the street, I mean, we're looking at it from day to day. Then once I went home and there were U-Haul trucks all up and down both sides of the street. This is a residential area. To this day, if you go and you'll watch people, because there's a railroad track, you'll watch people driving backwards and it's a one-way street. If they think they're gonna get cut, stopped by the train, and the trains are still pretty long, I've seen people do a U-turn and barrel up a one-way street to try to beat the train at the other two or three spots. That's very dangerous. Mm-hmm. That's a leadership issue. Mm-hmm. That's a city, yeah. So, I mean, I think that I say it's a leadership because it's the South. I never thought I grew up in the South until I got to New York. and then I started feeling it. But compared to the state, you guys, it's, you know, compared to the political image that you have in Congress and in the Senate, it's kind of, I tease my brothers about it, but it's sad. Mm-hmm. But Louisville itself is a great place, was a wonderful place. It was a safe place for us. I'm now that I'm out, you know, in Louisville, I mean, out of Louisville, I'm in New York, and looking back, I can see how wonderful it was, how safe it was, how much it had to offer. And it probably, everything had gone, maybe in 10, 15 years, it would be what I would have wanted my kids to grow up there and have, you know.
You talked about the library.
It's
been closed for a while.
And they've been closed for many years. The librarian, I used to go, my mother would take us to the library.
And this was on 28th Street, right?
28th and Virginia. Yeah, it was a beautiful place. I learned how books were cataloged. But I didn't know until after my parents died that there was a relationship, and a long time relationship, with the librarian and our family. Hmm. So the librarian knew our names, obviously, knew my dad from even before they were, my parents were married. So she looked after us. Hmm. She looked after us. We had a police officer who retired. I think he retired right before the riot, or maybe right after the riot. He had been walking that 28th Street beat, because it was a business district, for like 40 years. He knew me, he knew all of my brothers, he knew how old we were, he knew all the kids on the block. He walked that block for as long as he was there, and he retired right before or right after that riot. That's what we need. This was a young white guy that grew up in the neighborhood with us, you know, mm-hmm. as a police officer. Yeah.
So when you were in Virginia, it was a more of an integrated neighborhood?
No.
Okay.
No. Because I think that my parents bought it from a German family, but I don't remember any or very few whites, except for a family that lived on this side of the tracks, right by the railroad, mm-hmm. right on the railroad tracks, it looked like to me. And when we moved there, one of them, we just know who, we don't know which one, but threw a rock in the door. We had a plate glass door. And on the first week, I think, he was high, threw a rock in the window. My dad put plywood there, and proudly kept that plywood in until it actually made, my brother got a new door. But that was just recently because he wanted us to remember that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it, was there tension? Is that when the neighborhood changing?
Or yeah. Yeah. I think what happened was that blacks started to buy houses in that neighborhood. Once two or three got moved in, then others came. And, you know, you think, I've heard that people were afraid that the property values would drop, but they didn't drop. They just went up, because every time you sell a house, you make money, you know? So that was like bogus. And it was a quiet neighborhood, very quiet, very peaceful. Everybody went to school. All of my friends went to college. The people my age, and there were a lot of kids on the block. And from there to Virginia Avenue, to the school. Mm-hmm. So that was the best for us.
When did you leave Louisville?
I left after college, after high school. High school. Yeah, I knew it. So here, I went to Atherton. I went to Atherton. That was, when it comes to busing, I've always been bused. I took the bus to school, the transit. What is it called? Louisville Transit? I don't know what the bus system is called. Yeah. Okay. I took that. It was an hour and a half to get to school every morning to get to Atherton. I didn't want to go. I cried for the first 3 or 4 weeks on my way to school, but I'm still in touch with some of the guys right to this day. I just, you know.
So were you assigned to Atherton, or did you?
No. They didn't start assigning until after I was gone.
Okay.
This was before the signing. I think Atherton was a school that was outside of the district, outside of the city. But it was part of the public school system. So taxpayers' money, if you lived in Louisville, you were paying for Atherton. And I believe the story was that they were, demanded that they had, that Atherton had to integrate. Mm-hmm. Their thing of integrating, because it was in a Jewish community, was to bring some white folks from the South End, from Portland, to Atherton. They had one teacher who lived across the street from us, who was also very, very fair. She was teaching at Atherton, and they probably didn't realize that she was Black. Mm-hmm. But that's how my mother probably found out that they were looking for some brown-skinned kids to go to that school. And so I was one of the first. All of us did very well out there. All of us did real well. So that's where I went. And then I had been in the summertime. We had been going to camp, to a Quaker camp in Vermont. So I had never been so far away from home. I was 11 years old. Was I 11? Maybe I was 12 when my very first train ride by myself. It wasn't by myself. It was a group of kids and a chaperone. But my mother took us to Cincinnati to take the train to Vermont. And the rest is history. So I would go to Vermont as much as I could. I loved being out in the open, you know, and it's Quaker camp. It's called Farm and Wilderness Camp. Make a plug for Farm and Wilderness Camp, because they were bringing kids who were involved in civil rights movements all over the country to go to camp as a safety measure. Mm-hmm. And the Bradens, and Braden's kid, Jimmy Braden, and I were good friends. We actually went to male's prom together. And we were told to be ready for problems at the prom. So I had a pair of jeans on, cut off jeans under my outfit at the prom. And I was ready to take off shoes and get out if I needed to. But Farm and Wilderness was bringing kids up to camp. They had 1 year, and I had been there long enough. They had two of Malcolm's kids Attila, and I don't know the other kid, but I still am in touch with Attila Shabazz today. They had Andrea Young was there. They had Donzele Abernathy was there. And I was the Black counselor. And I was, I'm telling you, it was the best for me. It was, I was in heaven because.
What kind of things would you learn there?
Say that again.
What kind of things were you learning at this camp?
Well, it's a Quaker camp. Mm. So it was, even though they had people from all over, they had Hindus, they had Buddhists, a lot of Buddhists. They had Jewish folks. The one thing that you would know that it was a Quaker camp was that we had silent meditation every morning, 15 minutes of silence every morning. And on Sunday, and it wasn't mandatory, it was a half hour of silence if you wanted to. And everybody wanted to, everybody. And I'm a Quaker to this day. Even though I believe in AME, Zion, that was my grandparents, my great grandparents' church. And I believe the Church of God, or Sanctified Church, I absolutely do. I'm right now practicing Quaker. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So when did you start getting involved in like social justice movement?
But that's everything that I'm talking about now. Uh-huh. Is social justice. As a child, as a baby, my mother and parents took us, and our grandparents did the same thing for them. And the great grandparents, you know, they were landowners, they were homeowners. And the I have a picture of my great great grandmother on my daddy's great grandmother. So it's my great great grandmother on the porch of her house. So, I mean, that's the justice movement has always been here. It's nothing new. It's been here for hundreds of years. And it's going to be, and before that, I'm sure there was another one. It just wasn't my family. I don't know. But I'm telling you, there was never a beginning, and there's not going to be an end until everybody has justice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we're all going to live it peacefully. Are we gonna not have it at all and die, all of us?
So where'd you go to college after you graduated from Athens?
So I actually had a four-year scholarship, room and board included, at the University of Louisville. Mm-hmm. And I started there. I was I started with Blaine Hudson. Did you know Blaine?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, Blaine. I don't know who else was there from that era, but we were all together. And Blaine has tried for years to get me to come down to talk about, you know, I guess social justice or the Black Student Union in those days. Mm-hmm. In 68, I think it was 68. And I just, things busy. I was busy, I guess. And now this, the second I could do it, he died. Mm. Yeah. So I went there 1 year.
Did you help start the Black Student Union?
I did. I was the only girl to be arrested in that initial administrative takeover, which wasn't a takeover. It was a show. It was all just to show that we were serious about what we thought was needed there, which was, a comforting place for Black students. When I was there, my scholarship was in literature, but I had started at the Speed Museum drawing when I was a kid, when I was 14 or 15, I think. And this was another person who lived in the neighborhood that we lived in that told my mother, here's a place, an opportunity for your kids to go, you know, to learn how to draw. Here's the Actors League. Hmm. What was the name of this? The Children's Actors. Well, we were in a couple of semi-professional, you know, we were the street urchins or the kids that could sing on the corner in some of the plays. I can't remember exactly what it is, but actually my brother Reggie is was on the board of that place for a long time. Now tell me, you just asked me something.
Wanted to know about U of L, like what was it that you felt
that's
was
right.
lacking and why, so, how the student, like student union came about?
So yeah, this is, and this is a, I'm gonna give an antidote too about something that happened in New York. But we were watching, I was so happy to be just in Louisville and at, you know, and on campus, and really I was able to immerse myself with these guys. They were almost all guys because it was the football, the basketball, the baseball team were all Black men. And then there were a couple of guys who were, medical students, then a couple of lawyers, and then there was Blaine, who was the philosopher, and he was the well-read person. We would always get together in the morning or at night, play chess at night, in the morning just talk. And it was the you know, when you used to see the pontificating there was a show. And they used to make jokes about pontificating, but this was the real stuff. This was real deal. And these people, we were really very serious about it, and talking about how things should be. There should be, like, I was always the only Black, or maybe one or two. I was the only, there were three of us on campus who had dorm rooms on campus. So we thought that there should be a lot more, it just should be more of us around. And then instead of just giving us white history, give us some African history. Instead of just giving us, you know, talking about, I don't know, give us some South American history. Mm-hmm. So we one day went through, and often Blaine would have read the New York Times before we got up in the morning. And so he'd say, look at this. One day he said, look at this. And he showed us a picture of Columbia students, front page students, a picture of three guys with a rifle and the berets, you know, and they had taken over the student building, the administration building, and they were demanding Black Student Union. And we looked at each other, we could do that. Why don't we do that? And the rest is history. That's exactly what we did. Now, when it came time to actually go and take over the building, that's another story. There was about six of us. And are we still gonna do this? We really gonna do this? I said, well, I'm doing it. I didn't come all the get up early and do, you know, I'm doing it. So who else is going? So there were several of us who went in. The administrator, whose office we took over, was a great guy. He said, listen, let us not get into any trouble. Let me just stay here with you and assure everybody that everything's, and it went really well. However, when they came to arrest us, one of the officers said, I'm going to show you how we do this in Louisville. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, I think we're in trouble. And he picked me up by the shirt and drug me out to be arrested. And I said, well, that didn't go so well. That didn't go like we planned, because nothing happened to the kids. Those students at Columbia were not arrested. And they made it, our folks made it very clear that in Kentucky, you're gonna be arrested. Mm-hmm. Now, let's see, it was 1989. I was being recruited for Harlem Hospital to work at that facility, Harlem Hospital. I walk into the office of the administration's office, and I see that New York Times article in a frame on the wall with the picture. And I said, oh my gosh, I know that picture. Turns out the picture was of the deputy director, his Sherman McCoy. He was the one in the middle holding the rifle. And he was now, and he's, and then he went on from Harlem to become the director at Howard University Hospital. So So these guys who, you know, did this at Columbia were, they were no joke either. They went on to do wonderful things. So that's another that's another story. We talked about how he the administration at Columbia dealt with the student body demands and ours. But Columbia had the very first affiliation of Black colleges, of hospitals, public hospitals. They were the first affiliation in New York State and probably in the country. So they had, they also had a small student, a Black student body in the medical school and the law school as well. So they were a little bit ahead of Louisville, but we were right behind them, University of Louisville. However, I told you that Miss Hutchison was a neighbor, and she had the Speed Museum. They had an art place where students could come and learn to draw. And so she had actually helped me get into that school, but Atherton also, into University of Louisville, but Atherton had also a teacher, Mary Bernard, who I loved and who loved me. And because I could draw, I was her favorite student for a long, long time. And so she wanted me to go to Pratt Institute in New York City. Well, New York City, Brooklyn, New York, Harlem, to me, it was the same. But she had the last word because it was, she was teaching at Atherton, and I decided I really wanted to go to Atherton. So once I got kicked out of University of Louisville, I had to wait until they, quote, reinstated me, which they did. But by the time they reinstated me, they didn't reinstate all of my scholarship. And I was already enrolled at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. Yes, and happy. And I have a meeting, the same kind of meeting for oral history with them next week.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know what the deal is. I don't, by the time I got to Pratt, all I was interested in was art. Yeah, I wasn't politically active in terms of they had the Black Panther Party doing something with Pratt. I was oblivious. I was in France in the summer times. So I was oblivious to that. So I told them, well, I can only talk of my experience at the school. They did not, once again, Pratt did not teach Black history or Black art history or any other history except the Renaissance, you know? So that was one of the issues I had there. But I loved Pratt.
So how did living in New York change your perspective on Kentucky when you came back to visit your family?
Okay. So I told you before, I never thought that I lived in the South until I lived in New York. And it's very clear Kentucky at that time when I left was Southern, definitely Southern. Dick Gregory had come into when he was running for president in Louisville, and he had come to Louisville, and he said, you know, he had said something like, in Kentucky, they treat horses better than they treat, and he used the N-word, which I never have used. I'm trying not to ever use it, but that word was used in New York City ad nauseum, and I still have not embraced it. We don't embrace it to this day. Mm-hmm. But he said they treat horses better than they treat y'all down here. So you got to do something about it. But I had written some. Hold on one second. Now, my perspective is, Louisville was a safe haven. These are notes I read. Louisville was the safe haven. It was home. And in 1969, New York, however, provided the curiosity, not the curiosity, but the curious. It was a global culture, the stimuli. And New York to me was like, this is where the globe is so big. The world is so big. The more you more you travel, the smaller it gets. So I've traveled a lot. And I just am very fortunate, the people that I've met here. I think that it was at that time, I believe it was like a cultural mecca. People came, even in the Black arts. But it's just now, 30 years late, 40, my daughter's 50 years later, that the Black artists are even at the Smithsonian, you know? So it's still a long walk. I believe it's moving. The Dow is moving, but it's moving awfully mm-hmm. slow. It's so slow.
Yeah. Yeah. When over the last year, we've had a lot of like the Black Lives Matter demonstrations and things like that. So given your history, when you heard about what happened with Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, I mean, how do you feel about that? And
how do I feel surprised? About it?
Well, I mean,
no, I'm not surprised. Did it
make you make
not at all surprised
with what you went through?
In Louisville, there was the killing of the first Black, I believe she was an assembly person. There was the killing of a couple of the civil rights leaders. Mm. There was the marginalization of Black boys. I saw that. It's never stopped. It has not stopped. And in New York, it was already, I guess, prominent, because by the time I got there in the 70s, Harlem was, and I started working at the hospital later, but Harlem had a terrible reputation as being crime and a lot of drugs, but it was also a mecca for artists. It was a wonderful place. A lot of great people live and still live in Harlem. Mm-hmm. Yeah, including my youngest brother, you know? The hospital, Harlem Hospital, there's a whole section called Stryver's Row that's since the 20s, Black artists, Black doctors and judges and have lived there. This is, to me, I think the rest of the country maybe is made aware of it. And certainly it looks like white people just found out about it. Black Lives Matter? Of course Black Lives Matter. I mean, that's not a new move. It is a new movement. It has a name, but it's not nothing. It's nothing new. They've been lynching Black people forever. Mm-hmm. Yep.
How did you go from studying art to working in hospitals? What was that?
So remember, art is pervasive everywhere you go. I mean, you can. So I freelance with my ex, who is a New York Times, was worked for the New York Times for 40 years. So I freelanced for almost 15 years in design, illustration. And remember, I went to, I was going to University of Louisville for literature so I could write. So I can write. And that, I think, has helped me get into public affairs. I found that the schools that most of the kids in New York went to didn't teach people how to read and write. And that's a travesty. And so you could see the damage in that next generation. So, you know, at the time we were talking about Black studies, if those kids had been taught to read and to write a sentence, a correct grammatically correct sentence, they would have a better shot at all kinds of stuff. But these folks, even the lawyers, you know, that I know, that they just don't read and write. And they certainly don't dialogue. So I did that for a while. So when maybe 10 years, but when we split up, with my ex and I split up, then I had to get a job. Mm. And the arts and Black arts were not paying. I had a wonderful, lived on Roosevelt Island, a marvelous place. It's beautiful, but it's got a high overhead. So I had to get a J-O-B. And it just so happened, well, the first job that I got was at the NAACP National Office in Public Affairs, Public Relations. So I left that, and there was a hospital that was looking for somebody to do PR for them. And they were paying good money. And I'm saying, whoa, I could do that. So that's where I started, North General Hospital. And I stayed in the hospitals for 12 years. I went to work in the mayor's office for 2 years, then HRA, which is the Human Resources Administration, which is like, they take care of welfare payments and, you know, Medicaid and that kind of stuff. And then I went back to hospitals. Mm-hmm. You have to write, you have to design, you have to be a people person, you have to, there is a job for everybody in a hospital. It is a microcosm. It's very complex. There's all kinds of professions in there, but you got to be a professional, whatever you do, because there are a lot of standards that have to be maintained. So it's like a little city in a hospital, the smallest hospital.
So have you always stayed in New York since you left Louisville?
Yes, I've always been in New York. Right now I'm in the town of Poughkeepsie, but my life is in New York. Yeah, I mean, my livelihood, I'm still going to work every day.
Yeah. So how often do you get back to Louisville now?
I have not been back since my mom passed. So that was 2-3 years ago now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have, you know, it's like we have the property, we have property in the farm property that's very, we have a lot of stuff to do in the farm. So I've been there since I've been to Louisville. But I talk to Lamont, to Michael, all the time. I talk to him at least once a week. So he called me about Breonna Taylor. I didn't find out until he said, boy, but I'm not surprised, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And your brothers have been really involved in politics in Louisville. You had a brother as an alderman, he's state senator, original. And so is that just a streak, you said, that runs in your family? You said social justice has always been there.
I don't know that we would have called it that, but when you're seeking the best and what's right for the most people, that's what it is. And that's what, if all of us did that, it's like getting the vaccine, you know, the COVID vaccine. If we all do it, we'll be good. We'll be all right. Yeah. So, I mean, and Lamont, I call him Lamont. His name is Michael Lamont. Mm-hmm. I got dibs on Lamont. But for him, he was also, he worked for the state, for the state legislative resource. So he's always been industrious. You know, everybody, my brother up here is, he worked for Black Enterprise. You said you worked for the Defender. He worked for the Amsterdam News as managing editor for, and then he started working for the Black Enterprise. And when Black Enterprise moved over to television, and he moved over to the television, so he's still at Black Enterprise. He does his own, has his own business, but that's his client is Black Enterprise. Mm-hmm. So we're all in this. You know, we come from good folks. We're always put around good folks. We didn't have a choice. Our parents did this for us. Thank God. Thank goodness. Yeah. And our grandparents and their parents before them. So when we do something now, we're doing it for our great grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all questions I had. Is there anything else that I didn't ask you about, or anything you wrote in your notes you want?
I'm looking. Yeah, I'm looking. I wanted just to, let's see. Buttons, Girl Scouts, safety. stability of housing lets families, you know, better themselves, the personal. They're not thinking about how they're going to make money to pay the rent. Yeah, you had said, what's the legacy of urban renewal on the community of West Louisville? Mm-hmm. And my answer was, in Little Africa, it turned home ownership into renters and nomads, as far as I could tell. And I was 2 or 3 years old. And so that's probably why we know about open housing. Another thing is the churches were also active in those open housing and social justice and all of that. So we were all church oriented. Mm-hmm. There they are in New York. So our church, not so much the church, but the people in the church, the sanctified church, Church of God, those were my cousins and my family, and we were all family. Mm-hmm. I think that's all. New York provided stimuli. Nope, that's all. I don't have, holy cow, did I say all of that?
Yeah.
Uh-oh, sorry.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your time. I've really enjoyed this.
I hope that it's helpful. I'm sitting here looking at all of my buttons, at the oldest buttons. I've got another set of buttons here somewhere. Let me just see if I can show it to you. Can you see them?
Yes.
And then it says freedom, freedom. That was it was a heads wrap that they gave us at some point for a march. And I don't know, I think it was an open housing march, because it was the open housing marches that were, when I was at Atherton, that I would sneak away. Don't use the term sneak, because my parents were concerned for my safety. But those were the marches that I was, I guess, most active in, because I was a teenager. I had the energy. Mm-hmm. And I had a really good friend, Randy Bledsoe, whose sisters were Bledsoe sisters. One was an attorney at Legal Aid. And when we were kids, when we were teenagers at Atherton, and we were just, you know, we knew where to go. We went to the coffee houses there was a coffee house where people would gather on Broadway in the West End right before a march that just happened to be 2 doors down from my cousin, one of the ones in the church, the one that played the piano in church. So, I mean, yeah, this was a family affair.
How would you find out about the open housing marches?
Well, again, it's word of mouth. And I told you, I gave my source up. So don't give my source up. That was Randy. Randy's now, I think she was in Boston as a headmaster of a school for a while. These are brilliant people, you know, and what's going to impact if you're doing the right thing, it'll impact more people, like our elected officials. We need to get out there and support them all the time. Our electeds, our people who are within who are civil servants, essentially. And that's what I am now, a civil servant, because I work for a public hospital. Yep. And we work hard.
Do you ever get to interact with people like Georgia Powers, who was organizing those open housing marches?
As a matter of fact, yes, indeedy. Yep. But not in the way, I'm not sitting with her because I'm a kid. Mm-hmm. But we absolutely knew Georgia Power. We all absolutely knew, you know, the group from Chicago that came. I think it was Jesse came for a Jackson was here for a short while. But there's a guy who was another guy that looked like Jesse to me who was down here. Jose Williams was here. And I met Jose when I came back to New York. Abernathy was here. A.D. King, that's where those people came from. A.D. King was here, and he had a daughter that was we're almost the same age. she's a little younger than me, but he always made sure, AD always made sure that I, that his daughter was with me when we were on a march. So, I mean, that was the kind of closeness. He knew that I would take care of, I would take care of people, so.
All right, well, thank you very much. I know you got a meeting coming up.